Edutainment Learning is powered by Academica Virtual Education and Collegia TV. For more information, visit www.edutainmentlearning.com.
Richard Michael Mullane, and I was a mission specialist in the early years of the space shuttle program. I flew three times on the space shuttle, on the 12th, the 27th, and the 36th missions. Two of those were secret military missions. The first was a commercial satellite launch. We had three satellites to deploy from the space shuttle.
And I understand that you have a video that you wanted to share with the kids, like what it's like to launch. Sure. Will we be able to check that out right now?
Yeah, let me do that right now, and we'll do that first.
Yes, sir.
Let's see here. And I better put this back to beginning. Okay, thought I'd just run through what a space shuttle launch was like. Around 3 hours before liftoff, we'd walk from the crew quarters, climb into the crew van, drive to the launch pad, take the elevator to the cockpit level, exit that, walk across the access arm. Right about here, your heart's in your throat. No question about that. You're scared. We get dressed in the white room. We get dressed in our harnesses, crawl into the cockpit. Technicians are inside to help us lay us back into our chairs and strap us to the chairs. Then they leave, close the side, hatches closed, the access arm is retracted, and we're left alone. And we're going to be out there a minimum of 2 hours, and many times it's much longer than that because you have delays associated with weather, other issues that they have to check out. But you have a lot of time on your mind when you're out there. And believe me, you are in the grips of two fundamental emotions, one of which is fear, gut fear. You will fear for your life while you're out there. Same time that fear is on you, you're going to be boundlessly joyful, because for most astronauts, it truly is a lifetime quest to make this flight. With that in hand, you'll be overwhelmed with joy. When that occurs, we get this heavy vibration in the cockpit. T0, the hole bound bolts blow, the solid rocket boosters ignite, and we're slapped into our seats with a force of about 2 G's. 2 times gravity as the rocket leaps from the launch pad. 2 minutes and 12 seconds left, the booster is going out and separate. That occurs, you hear a loud bang, you see a whip of fire across the swim screens as these boosters are explosively separated. And then it was like a light switch. For the next 6.5 minutes, we continue into space on the three liquid fueled engines, burning gas out of that big orange gas tank. But from here on up, it was very smooth, very quiet. The only way you could tell you're moving, besides look at the instruments, where the G-force is slowly rising in your body, ultimately those stabilized at 3 G's, 3 times the force of gravity. And then 8.5 minutes up, the autopilot shuts off the engines, the gas tank is empty, it was jettisoned, all the remain now headed to orbit was a winged vehicle. We call that the orbiter. And now we're on our way to the International Space Station, where, well, it's a place I never got to, because I left NASA in 1990, and the first piece of the space shuttle was not launched until 1990. So I thought I'd just share that with you to set you up for the question period. So I'll go ahead and stop sharing now and come on back to you guys. Okay?
Yes, sir. Is it okay if we jump right into questions?
Sure. Yeah, fire away.
Okay, our first question, it comes from Raul, and Raul is in Spain. Raul, you should be able to unmute to ask your question.
Yes, first of all, it's great to be here. And you, like so many other astronauts, are such an inspiration to kids like me in Spain who dream with the stars. My question is, how has your perspective on Earth from space influenced your views on humanity's responsibility to our planet? And what lessons do you believe we can learn from space exploration in order to address the challenges and inspire a positive change on Earth?
Well, I'll tell you, one thing comes home to you when you're in space is there's no other place to go. I think Carl Sagan's pale blue dot, I don't know if you've ever seen that. It's out there on the internet, and I would encourage you to take a look at it. It's his narration, his philosophical take on humanity and the Earth as seen from the Voyager spacecraft when it was millions and millions of miles from Earth. It's the title of the program is called Pale Blue Dot, and it's narrated by just said his name. But anyway, just Google that. You'll see him out there. Carl Sagan. When you're up in space and you look out at the world, it is, you know, very obvious. There's not any place you're going to get to that you're going to be able to live, not for a very long time. It might never. And so clearly we have a responsibility to taking care of the Earth. You can see evidence of pollutions and pollution and rainforest destruction, things like that. They're even visible from space. And clearly we have to be better stewards of the planet, because like I said, that's it. We're not going anywhere else. As far as using space exploration to advance care of the world, again, it's the perspective. The more people we get up there and see it, and a lot of them are going to be a lot better at describing it, poets and artists, they'll be a lot better at describing the significance of it than us engineer astronauts. So they'll be coming back and doing a better job. But there's a lot that we can improve upon from space, obviously, with the machines, the robots that we have up there monitoring climate, oceanography, those type of things. So next question.
Yeah, absolutely. And if you guys want to learn more about Colonel Mullane, definitely check out MikeMullane.com. So we have a question from Europe, and this comes from Delhi. Delhi, go ahead and unmute to ask Colonel Mullane your question. We could be having some microphone difficulties there. So Delhi wanted to know, how did it feel in space with such low gravity? Is it uncomfortable or comfortable?
Well, there's three main physiological effects that occur fairly quickly when you're in orbit. One is very bad, and that's space sickness. About half the astronauts get sick and get nauseous and end up vomiting. I was in the lucky half that did not get sick. But obviously, that's going to be a downer if you're one of the people that are have to deal with that. We do have injectable anti-nausea drugs that are used now to knock down that nausea. But certainly, it's not something you don't want to be on these type of drugs up there. But that's necessary in some cases. The other thing is you grow taller up there, and the reason for that is the vertebrae our vertebrae are the bones are crunched down by gravity here on Earth. In weightlessness, those vertebrae relax apart. The discs absorb fluid because you have a fluid shift in your body. That's the third change up there, major physiological change. There's a fluid shift that equalizes the fluid in your body, and that causes these discs to swell and push the vertebrae apart, and you grow taller. I was an inch and a half taller in space than I am right now. Problem with that is it gives you a very bad lower back ache, because the muscles of the lower back don't stretch right away to make room for this longer spine, and you get a terrific back ache as a result. And it takes, well, my longest mission was only a week, and I had a back ache the whole time. And I've talked to astronauts who've been up there on the space station. They say it takes about a month before the muscles stretch out and that back pain isn't there anymore. And then that fluid shift also makes your head full and kind of puffy. It also tricks your kidneys to believe that you have too much fluid in you, so you end up peeing a lot when you get up there on orbit to reach a normal hydrated state for weightlessness, which, by the way, makes you dehydrated if you were back on Earth. But you're not. You're up there, so it's no problem. But on reentry, the reverse process occurs, where the fluid is being pulled out of your head. And on reentry, there's a danger you could faint because of lack of fluid in your body. So we take salt tablets and drink large quantities of fluid before we reenter the atmosphere to basically plump ourselves up with more fluid, so it's less likely we're going to faint. We also wear anti-G suits on reentry to fight this, which are just like tourniquets on your thighs and on legs and your belly that just try to prevent the fluid from being pulled out of your upper body and out of your head and causing you to faint on reentry. Obviously, you don't want to do that. So it's fun up there. You're weightless, you're floating around. That's all fun. But there are some downsides that I just described there.
Ovidu, go ahead and ask your question.
I was curious. Wait, does my audio work?
I think he's having audio issues. His question was regarding your training. Can you describe some of the training that you went through?
Well, most of it is, well, the training is begins when you first walk in. Obviously, you sit in a lot of meetings, learning a lot about how the system's set up. But we start simple with learning one system. Like we'll learn the hydraulic system or the electrical system or the navigation system or the main engine system, whatever it is. You learn one system. And you learn malfunctions associated with it. And eventually you then move into a simulator where if you're in the simulator, it's just as if you were in a cockpit of a space shuttle. It doesn't look from the outside anything like a space shuttle. It's like a box, really. But it's inside. It has all the computers running just like they would in a real space shuttle. And you're seeing the displays exactly as you would see them in space. And those simulators are hooked in with a simulator supervisor called SimSoup, who will then introduce malfunctions into various systems. And so you can learn how to respond to them in emergencies. And by having to do that, you learn the systems at a much deeper level than you would just sitting around reading about them in a book. So you spend a lot of time in simulations where you have all these malfunctions being thrown at you. Some of the simulations were linked in with mission control, so their instruments look as if they've got a shuttle in orbit, and they're following these malfunctions and trying, you know, as a team with mission control and the crew, we're trying to fix these problems. So it's a good way to learn very deep into the systems and how they all interact with each other. We also have simulators for the robot arm. You'll go to a building and they had time. They probably do it with CGI now, but when I was there, they had a mock-up of the shuttle cargo bay, 50 feet long, 12 feet in diameter. They had these gigantic helium-filled balloons that were simulate weightless payloads, and then we had this robot arm that we could use to practice grappling a payload in space and releasing it cargo bay. So we had that simulator. And then we had simulators for the spacewalks, so the big gigantic swimming pool where we'd practice spacewalks. So basically, NASA's philosophy on training is if it can be simulated, they simulate it. That's the best way you can learn things, is to have something that looks like it's the real world.
Next slide. And so one of the kids, we're getting quite a few questions about your experience as a veteran. And can you talk about being a pilot during Vietnam, and thank you for your service. Was there some type of synergies from being a combat pilot to being an astronaut?
Well, let me tell you, first off, I was not a pilot. My eyesight was too poor to be a pilot. If you saw the movie Top Gun, Maverick and Goose, I was a goose flying in the back seat of fighter jets. The F-4 Phantom, I don't know if you're familiar with that. That's what I was doing in my Air Force career. I was actually flying in the back seat of the reconnaissance version of the F-4 Phantom in Vietnam. So our mission was to fly alone, very fast, very low altitude over enemy targets, photographing enemy targets for the intelligence people. And as far as being able to translate that experience into the cockpit of a shuttle, anytime you're dealing in high stress situations, obviously combat's got a lot of high stress situations, and that is very helpful when you move into another high stress situation. Believe me, the shuttle is a high stress environment when you're riding those things. So there's a definite one-for-one translation there that I think helped you have a leg up, basically, when you go in there, having dealt with these very tight, dangerous situations. Both of them have their moments.
Okay. So I think it's safe to say you're really good under pressure.
Well, I hope so. There are times I had to be.
I bet. We have a question from Hugo. And guys, we're going to get through as many questions as we can. Hugo, you can unmute. You had a good question.
Yes, absolutely. So first of all, thank you very much for your intervention. That will help many of us, I think. And I would like to know, what in your childhood, for example, what gave you this passion and maybe, well, this desire to become an astronaut, and on which of your abilities or your skills did you rely on to make your projects come true?
Well, when you start talking about, I had an early dream. Well, let me go back. I was born 3 weeks after World War II ended. I know that seems like a million years ago, but well, it was, I guess. But I was born 3 weeks after World War II ended. My dad was a World War II aviator. So after the war, as I was a little boy, maybe 5, 6, 7 years old, growing up in the aftermath of World War II, there were all these Hollywood movies about the heroics of our airmen in World War II. My dad had his stories of World War II to fill me in on, along with my brothers. And so from a very, very early days, I had an intense fascination with flying. I wanted to grow up and be what my father had been. I wanted to be a flyer. I wanted to be a pilot. And as soon as they had jets, I wanted to be a jet plane pilot. And actually, I was growing up in a world where they were starting with some of the early jets. But simultaneously, Hollywood was churning out these movies when I was a 8, 9, 10 year old boy on astronauts going to the moon and Mars and these other planets. So that was a big influence on me. But the big, big event in my young life was I was 12 years old when Sputnik was launched, starting the space race. So I was growing up during the space race, totally captivated by it. And I wanted to be an astronaut as soon as I heard the word. I was very blessed in my life to have the right opportunities for me that allowed me to progress to the point where I could compete to be an astronaut. There was nothing I was doing that, frankly, nothing any astronaut does that guarantees they're going to be an astronaut, because I guarantee there's 10 or 20 or 100 of you that have identical qualifications. So in the end, why you get selected and somebody else doesn't, I don't know. That's fate, God, whatever you want to attribute it to. But that was in my blood to want to be an astronaut. I couldn't turn away from it. The analogy I use, because it is a fearful type of business. There wasn't a time on those space shuttles that I didn't fear for my life. There was no question that I could die on these things. People hear that and wonder, how can you swallow back the fear? Well, my answer is to use the analogy of Mount Everest climbers. Those people are hiking up to the top of that mountain, passing rock piles under which are the bodies of past climbers who died. And I know in their brains, there is a fear greater in their brain than ending up under the next pile of rocks. Their fear, their greatest fear, isn't dying. Their greatest fear is not reaching the top of that mountain. It's the same with astronauts. It's in our DNA. We have to do it. Our greatest fear is not making the ride into space. It's not the fear of dying is one thing, but the greater fear is not making that ride. It's hard to get your head around this, but that's the reality right there. And as far as other things in my life that served me well, I went to West Point. I needed that. It was I needed the discipline, the focus. Learning how to work under stress very early in my life at West Point. That was very important. I went back and got a master's degree in aeronautical engineering, which was critical to ultimately applying to be an astronaut. I also owe a lot to my wife, who had to stand by me during some very harrowing moments in my career. It's my parents, West Point, and my wife that helped propel me along the way to be an astronaut. Okay, next question.
That's amazing. So you're surrounding yourself with positive, supportive people. And I think that's something these kids can take with them regardless of what they're pursuing. A lot of the kids are asking this same question, and they wanted to know, what was the most difficult thing you had to overcome during one of your missions, and how did you overcome that?
Well, there are a couple near some really tight moments on my first mission. The free liquid engine started. Excuse me for a second. I'm still recovering from a upper respiratory issue here. On my first mission, We start those three liquid fueled engines because they can be checked by computer and shut off if there's a problem. Whereas once those solid rocket boosters ignite, you're irrevocably committed. You cannot turn those off. On the first attempt that we had at launching in 1984, June of 1984, first launch of the orbiter Discovery, the engines started. There was a problem with one of them. They shut down, which we had practiced that, but it still gets your attention, scares you when that happens. And then a fire started at the base of the vehicle. That really gets your attention when you hear the word fire and you're sitting on the top of 4 million pounds of propellant. So that was one of the moments where, you know, you really had to handle the fear and the reaction to it, as I've had to do in other parts of my life. The mission though that probably came the closest to ending very badly, as in the end period, was on my second mission. During launch, the tip of the right side solid rocket booster broke off and hit our heat shield, severely damaging about 700 heat tile that had to be replaced after we landed. But what was really the very close call is one of the heat tiles up in the nose area, which sees about 2300 degree Fahrenheit temperatures on reentry. There's silica tiles that are about 5 inches thick, but one of them had been blasted completely off the vehicle, exposing the under area to this heat of reentry. And when we got back and they took all these tiles off, there was a near burn through on the belly of the fuselage there. Had that occurred, that would have been the loss of the vehicle. So that was a situation where we had to rely on our training, our faith in mission control. And as it turned out, the engineers who designed the heat tiles, the heat shield, did a marvelous job so that even with one tile gone, it could sustain reentry through that heat. So I'm not sure. Was that question answered there?
It absolutely was. And one of the kids, Francesco, in Europe, had a really common question that seems to be coming through the chat here. Francesco, you should be able to unmute to ask.
Thank you. I'm really honored to be here, and I would like to ask you, how did you feel when you came back to Earth after a mission to space?
Well, when you get back, it's great to be back, with the family. Now, my missions were short. The longest mission was only a week. So I imagine the homecoming, when you're up there for months and months and months on a space station and you come home, the homecoming's more significant. But still, it was wonderful to get back. And I remember the first thing that happens is, like everything is the first mission. You've got to fly that first mission. You're so paranoid that something's getting in the way and prevent you from flying it. So it's so, so important. It's like you're praying to God, just give me this one mission and I'll never ask for anything again. Well, guess what? As soon as you land and you hear the term wheel stop, you're thinking, I want to do this again. So basically you come back thinking of the next time you're going to be able to go back into space. But it is nice to, two things that are, well, one thing for sure is nice to have when you get back is a shower. There's no shower up in space. And it's just, you feel disgusting after a week of not being able to take a shower. So that's also something very nice to come back to.
That's very interesting. We don't think about that, us people on civilians on Earth. Bosco, you had an awesome question. Go ahead and ask, my friend.
Yeah, what we need to study to become an astronaut?
Well, right now, I would encourage anybody that's interested in pursuing an astronaut career to make sure that you look at what NASA is currently hiring. Now, that's for kids that, obviously American citizens that we apply to NASA. ESA, I'm sure they have a website, the European Space Agency, which shows what their qualifications are. I suspect they're both the same in that science and engineering type of degrees are what they're looking for. Now, there's a lot of sciences too. So medical science, that's certainly one, but astronomy, biology, oceanography, meteorology, those are all sciences. So you could have interest in those and still be in a qualification to apply to be an astronaut. Then the engineering, aeronautical, electrical, mechanical, all sorts of engineering degrees would help you get in a position where you could compete to be an astronaut. But I would encourage you to make sure when you're, I know kids ask a lot of old people, and we're happy to give information, but in many cases, the information we're giving you is 30 or 40 years old. It's way, way out of date. So that's why I always tell kids, I'll give you my opinion, but don't take it and run with that. What you need to do is go to the websites for ESA, for NASA, and see what their qualification, what type of degree fields they need, are requiring to be able to apply to be an astronaut. I'd also encourage you to look at the biographies of recently selected astronauts, because you'll see what they had, what they did to make them, you know, put them in a position of getting selected. So make sure you do that.
Yeah, and we had a pilot on here. So do your research. So we have Lewis. Lewis, go ahead and unmute to ask Colonel Mullane.
Hi. Is it easy to put the suit on?
Sorry, I didn't understand.
Your suit. How, was it hard or easy to put on the space suit?
Oh, the space suit? Now, a couple different suits to talk about, or two. One is the pressure suit that we wear when we launch. The other would be a space suit. I did not do a spacewalk in my career, although I practiced for it. But the ones that you see people floating around in space, those things are monstrously large. They are very difficult to get into. It takes another person to help you dress in space in one of those. The other, the pressure, those orange pressure suits we wear when we walk out of the crew van to go climb into the vehicle, those are difficult. Well, they're easier than the other suit, faster to put on, but still uncomfortable and large and awkward to have on you. You get used to it after a while. You dress it in enough times, you get used to it.
One of the kids, they want, well, actually quite a few kids have asked this. This might be a silly question to you, but they want to know, what did you eat while you're in space?
Well, we care on the space shuttle in my era, we had a lot of dehydrated food, camping food, basically. If you ever have gone camping and gotten this dehydrated food where you have to add water back to it to eat it in bags and stuff, that's basically what we were carrying up in the space shuttle. We had dehydrated food. It was packaged different, and we had a machine that would pierce the plastic that this food container and squirt water into it. And then if it was a hot item, we had an oven you could put it in to heat up, and then you cut off the plastic top, peel it back, and eat with a fork and spoon like you would eat here on Earth. Got to eat kind of slow, though, or you have food flying everywhere. We did carry candy or M&Ms, butter cookies. Those were the best. You know, sitting at the window and looking at the world go by and eating M&Ms and butter cookies. Doesn't get any better than that. But we had some also, the what they call meals ready to eat, the same thing the soldiers carry when they're out there in the field. We had some of those. Now, I don't know for sure, but I imagine the food is better on the International Space Station. I'm sure it's still dehydrated in many cases, but they also have resupply vehicles go up there. So I suspect they might have periodic fresh vegetables, fresh fruit, things like that.
That's so fascinating. I never really thought about that until one of the kids asked that.
On that topic, just for a second here, one of the problems about getting to the moon and Mars, particularly Mars right now, current propulsion is a round trip is on the order of about 33 months, almost 3 years. And just think about it. When you're going to Mars, you're not going to have any place to stop to refill your commissary there. So everything that you're going to need for 3 years, you got to be carrying with you. Food, water, you know, everything. Toothpaste, toilet paper, everything. Just imagine 3 years of that. That start making you think about the oxygen and water and all that for 3 years, and you got multiple people. You get some idea of the scope of the difficulties it's going to be for humans to get to Mars. Okay, sorry about that. Go ahead.
No, you're fine. I mean, it's we don't really get to hear this perspective. And so this is absolutely fascinating to us. So Clara, go ahead and unmute. This is a question I was actually wondering myself, because I, you know, we put ourselves in these kind of scenarios. If I were to be shot into space, what kind of emotions would I feel? Clara wanted to know, did you have any anxiety when you're like away from Earth and you see it smaller? And like, what is that like?
No, I did not have any type of, there was periods, I guess, when you had a sense of being detached from humanity, but it wasn't scary. I think the people who are going to live, I've often said, no astronaut has gone into the great unknown. We send up robots, and then early on they sent up monkeys and other animals to make sure it was okay for us. I make the point the last humans to have ever gone in the great unknown, in my opinion, were the sailors of the 13th, 14th, 15th century. Those people had no clue what was beyond a 3-mile horizon. That's as far as they could see. They didn't send a monkey out. Magellan didn't send a monkey out and wait for it to come back. He just got on a ship and set sail. Those people truly sailed into the great unknown. Astronauts, in my opinion, have never done that, because we send up these robots and whatever to make sure it's okay for us. The next humans, since Magellan's people, those type of people, will be the people that go to Mars, because they're going to, at some point, they're going to, what they call trans Mars injection. Engines are going to fire. They're going to send propellant. They're going to stop. And now it's no coming back. They're absolutely committed. They are on their way to Mars and they're not coming back for 3 years. Those people are the ones that are going to see Earth diminished to just a blue white morning star. I can't imagine what it's going to be like. I mean, on the moon, you can see the Earth. I mean, I haven't been to the moon, but obviously you can see the Earth. It's fairly close. But just imagine being on the way to Mars and looking back and seeing, like we see Venus right now, just a bright morning star, and that's Earth, and you're that far from it. I can't imagine what that's going to emotionally feel like. Go ahead.
That is, I mean, just the thought of that actually gives me anxiety, being so far away from Earth. So this is from Jules. Jules is in France. Jules, go ahead and unmute to ask your question.
Hi, I just would like to ask you, how did you sleep? Because of the gravity, you had to be attached or not? Thanks.
Inside the cockpit?
Yeah, like how did you guys sleep or get rest?
Oh, sleep. Okay, I didn't hear that. We had they look like sleeping bags that are pinned to the walls or pinned wherever you want. Every position's identical in weightlessness, so there's no up or down or anything. But they look like sleeping bags, but they didn't really serve the function of a traditional sleeping bag. They were sleep restraints, we call them. Because when you think about it, in weightlessness, if you want to go to sleep, just close your eyes and go to sleep. Every position is the same. There's no such thing as laying down in a bed. There's no such thing as standing, sitting, dropping, spilling. All these are words that we only have in our vocabulary because we live in a gravity bag. In weightlessness, every position is the same. If you want to go to sleep, just close your eyes and go to sleep. The problem with that is you will drift around the cockpit and perhaps end up in an embarrassing embrace with a fellow crew member. So we have sleep restraints that we just basically zip ourselves into. They're pinned to the walls, the ceiling, the floor, wherever. And you just zip yourself into them, and those restrict you from drifting around. You're floating inside them. You're not laying in them. You're floating inside them. It's just that you are now constrained by those bags. And some people complain that they couldn't sleep without their head on a pillow. When you think about it, though, there's no gravity vector to pull your head into a pillow. So the engineers provided a foam block on the top of the sleep restraints with a Velcro strap that you could put across your forehead to pull your head into contact with this pillow to simulate having your head on a pillow. Some people needed that contact to be able to sleep. I personally found I was only up there again for max of a week, and found it very difficult to get any decent sleep. I found myself constantly turning inside the sleep restraint because my body wanted to feel a mattress against it. And so I'd nod off and I'd wake up and kind of thrash around inside this thing, my brain trying to seek some type of a mattress contact, which isn't there, obviously. So I imagine if you're up there for months and months and months, you'll get used to it and be able to sleep fine. But certainly for a week-long mission, did not sleep very well.
Did you ever like wake up and forget where you were at? Like, was there any moments like that?
No, I didn't have any moments like that. I didn't sleep deep enough to end up in a type of dream state where you might wake up and wonder what area. I've done that a lot here on Earth. Wake up, you travel a lot, sleep in a lot of different hotels, but I'll wake up and wonder, okay, what city am I in? And have to go back and trace the flights that got me there.
Yeah. I mean, I can't imagine. So one of the kids, a few of the kids asked this. We'll go with a couple more questions and we'll let you go because I know it's getting kind of late for some of our kids in Thailand. The kids, they wanted to know, was it difficult to walk? Because you mentioned about the back pain when you got back to Earth. Was it difficult to walk at all? Or what is that like?
The back pain was up in space because your spine lengthened. It would go, I mean, when you came back, you still had the pain for a while, but rapidly your spine compressed back to what it was. So the muscles were back in the right position. But walking, when you first land and get up out of your seat on a shuttle, you feel very lethargic, very heavy. Your feet feel like you have concrete boots on, a little awkward walking. You definitely want to be holding on to the stairs that they put up aside to the side of the space shuttle. You definitely wanted to hold on to those or else you're liable to end up falling head over heels on national TV. And I noticed too, during the day, the first day, that I would find myself reaching for the wall. I felt like I was falling. I'm sure for people who are up there for months and months, it takes a while before they get their land legs back. For people on the space shuttle, which the missions are very short, it was probably only the order of about, maybe 3 or 4 days before your body had readjusted to gravity.
And a couple of the kids asked this, is there any issue with like radiation when you go out into space?
That's for us in the space shuttle and the space station, it's not that big of a deal because we orbit underneath the protective shield of the Earth's magnetic field. It's a lot of wicked, wicked radiation out there, but our magnetic field shields it from getting to the Earth or getting to us if we're below it in an orbit. Where that's very dangerous is once you get out above the magnetic field, for example, going to the moon or onto Mars, you're very exposed there to some solar event, maybe a solar flare that could really dose you with some very dangerous killing radiation. So again, when you're talking about going to the moon or having a base on the moon or going to Mars, you're going to have to make sure you address that. There's going to have to be some part of the structure or the vehicle where you can wait out some type of solar event safely. Another issue with trying to get to these places. It is something you do. It is considered. We do wear dosimeters, these instruments that detect radiation, and NASA looks at those after we get back to make sure we have not taken a significant radiation dose. Theoretically, in this country, they have an agency called OSHA, Occupational Safety and Health Administration. But at any rate, NASA has to adhere to those regulations for radiation exposure. It's the same for people who work in nuclear submarines, people who work in nuclear power plants. There's rules on how much radiation you can be exposed to, and NASA has to live well under those same rules.
Again, you just blew my mind because of OSHA being involved with NASA, the same organization that makes sure that McDonald's is on point, makes sure that NASA is on point. All right. Before we let you go, I ask this of all of our guests. Is there any advice that you can give to these kids, Colonel Mike Mullane, as they go off in the world and figure out what they would like to do?
A couple of things I'd tell you right now is, one, do your best at everything all the time. I look back on my own life. When I went into the Air Force as a backseater, as a goose, I could not be an astronaut because at that point, NASA only selected test pilots for astronauts, and I couldn't be a test pilot because I wasn't a pilot. But I did my best for 10 years at everything I was doing, never thinking it was going to count for being an astronaut until 10 years later. After I got into the Air Force, 10 years later, NASA announced the new crew position on the space shuttle, Mission Specialist Astronaut, that did not require you to to be a pilot. So all of a sudden, there was an opportunity for me to apply to be an astronaut as a mission specialist. If I had not done my best for 10 years earlier, that constant 10 years, I would not have been able to compete to be an astronaut. So many times in life, you'll think, oh, this doesn't really count. I don't need to work hard on this. Trust me, it counts. Everything you're doing is going to count in your future. So do your best at everything. Another piece of advice here is dream big. Do not be timid when it comes to setting goals. Again, in high school, I was like that. I was very timid. West Point changed me. If it hadn't been for West Point, I shudder to think how it would have turned out. But in high school, I was constantly comparing myself to other boys. Oh, I can't try out for sports. They're better than me. They're better looking. I can't ask a girl out. They'll get a date. I won't. That was the type of mentality I had as a high school kid. And fortunately, West Point ended that in a big way. But don't depend on West Point or anything. Know that you can compete, that you can set the bar very high in your life. And even if you fall a little short, you learn things you can use then to apply to pushing the bar higher elsewhere in your life. So dream big, challenge yourself, do your best, take care of your body. You're only getting one in life. There's a lot of things out there that'll screw it up. Tobacco, violence, drugs, alcohol. Obviously, you want to stay away from all that stuff. And you'll go far in life if you just practice a few simple things like that.
Well, Colonel Mullane, we cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your valuable day to come talk to us, hundreds of students all over the world. So before I let you go, I traditionally allow everybody to thank our guests. And before I end the meeting for all, can we all unmute and can we all say thank you to Colonel Mike Mullane for taking the time out of his day to come talk to you guys?
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Very much. Bye. Bye.